Arjun Ram.
Okay.
And we'll get started.
Very good. So please find a nice place to sit. Okay, for this retreat, how many of you have been on a retreat with me before? Great, most of you, maybe some haven't. But we've only got a couple of days here, so in order to make the best of your time here, first of all, please keep quiet. Thanks for the noise. Which means I try not to have speaking, especially during the tea time and lunch periods. You don't really need to get to know one another, you need to go and get to know yourself. And to have some peace amongst yourself, rather than peace amongst others. In our world we have lots of opportunities to talk, to socialise, but here is a special occasion just to be as quiet as you possibly can. And of course that doesn't mean being stupid. If someone looks lost, they're looking for a place for the lunch, you just tell them the lunch is over there. But you don't get into a conversation with them. And secondly, if somebody starts talking, please don't sort of tell them off and scold them, because then that's two people talking. As I mentioned in the retreat which we did at Mary Ward Hall, there is a custom in the West, especially in England, that if somebody misbehaves, like talking when they shouldn't, you can give them the one finger sign. But not that one, this one. It doesn't matter what nationality a person is, they always understand the Buddhist one finger sign. To try and encourage people to be quiet. Because if you can maintain that silence with your mouth, it's much easier to be quiet inside. And after a few hours, after morning, maybe mid-afternoon, you get so comfortable being in each other's presence without needing to talk. Now that doesn't mean that you can't give each other a smile. Because for some people, not being able to talk is very difficult. They feel lonely, rejected. And just a tiny little smile when you pass one another or across the breakfast table is just worth much more than 1,000 words. So please smile at each other in the morning, afternoon, evening, whenever. And that is instead of talking. And also please, you haven't been told already, your iPhones, please turn them off. When you go into your bedrooms, I suppose, you can do whatever you like.
Not really.
Not really.
No.
Well, I used to say in England, as long as you don't scare the horses, it's okay.
Precious opportunity.
Precious opportunity. If you can, then please turn it off. But you know, sometimes the people worry, what's going to happen? So, okay, but don't disturb others. And next thing is, there are some people coming from outside, some people coming who are residents here, so we have to learn how to work together. Now, during the meditation, I think you all hopefully know how I teach meditation. This isn't about concentration, please. That's a very bad word, concentration. The actual word in the Eightfold Path meditation is samadhi. And it was a very unfortunate translation by Professor Rhys Davids over 100 years ago, maybe 140, 50 years ago now, to translate samadhi as concentration. And that's caused a lot of problems for many people in their meditation practice. When you try and concentrate, you use far too much force. You get very tense, very tight. And sure that with effort you can concentrate, you can hold your mind on an object for long periods of time. But there's no softness, there's no peace, there's no joy in it. It's just damn hard work. And after a while, the people get tired. Yes, sometimes you can get to a certain level of meditation. And then sometimes people can get these things which we call lights, nimittas in meditation, through concentration, through holding the mind tight. But I've never found anybody who could take it any further. It's as far as you can go. It's like just a short distance from here is Hampton Court Maze. And I remember going there as a kid. And you were going down one path, you'll get very, very close to the centre, but it was a dead end, you couldn't go any further. And that is why using force in your meditation. You get so far, there's a dead end. You can't get to the heart, the center of things. So the other way is this very beautiful, soft, peaceful way of not concentrating, but letting go. And letting go leads to stillness. Many of you have seen me do this simile before. I'll do it again just to make sure you understand it. Meditation is like getting a glass of water and bringing it to perfect stillness. The water in this cup or this glass represents my mind. And how can I get this water to be still? Has it stopped moving yet? Because I'm not paying attention, I'm not being mindful. I'm now being mindful. But it is moving because I'm not concentrating. So now I'll concentrate. And you can see here, honestly, I'm trying. It moves more. This simile is actually quite instructive. The more you concentrate, the more it moves. And many people meditate like this for years, trying to hold their mind still and becoming very frustrated. And once I say how to get this water to be still, it's so obvious, you think, how stupid can I be? You let it go. You put it down. And when you put your mind down, you leave it alone. You don't try and hold it. You don't fight it. You see, that water is perfectly still. There's no way I could ever hold it still as that. That is how meditation works. You let go and the mind becomes perfectly still. Now the difficulties many of you will encounter is how to let go. It seems so easy, but because we have never really learned how to let go, we've always learned how to do stuff, make things happen, to put forth effort in your lives. So learning how to let go is something totally new to people. So we give many interesting similes. I have been giving some similes at the retreat which we held at Mary Ward Hall on the weekend. But this simile I haven't mentioned yet. And this, I think I mentioned it in passing, but not really in depth. I've often noticed, not allowing to watch TV myself, watched when I go through airports, seeing other people watching these big screens, in particular in Singapore, because where I live, I usually go to Singapore Airlines and get connections from there. And they have big screen TVs for people in transit, and I see people watching the football. And I've seen this many times, passing by that huge screen and seeing a few people, probably English, could be anybody, sitting down there and shouting at the screen. There's a match on, Liverpool playing Manchester United, and they say, shoot, shoot, offside, offside left, you can't allow that. And when I saw that, I was really dumbfounded. Number one, doesn't matter how hard you shout in Singapore, you cannot hear that in Old Trafford, Manchester. And number two, it's a rerun. The match finished about 2 hours ago. But still people do that. And why? That was the interesting question. And it's not just men watching soccer. It's girls watching movies. Going back to where I spent 3 years of my life, happy years, at Cambridge. Every year we used to go to a very cheap movie theatre. They used to call them flea pits in those days, for good reason. Very, very cheap, very basic. Now to watch stupid movies, with your friends, students. And because it was students, no one took anything serious. And one of my movies, favourite movies from that time, which I remember to this day very clearly, was the horror movie Tarantula. Now please understand this was almost 50 years ago. So there was no special effects. Just somebody dressed up as a big spider. Crazy time. Anyway, so apparently the storyline was that this little tarantula was involved in a nuclear accident and mutated into being this huge monster, 100 times the size of a real tarantula, going around stalking people. Another thing I said in Mary Ward Hall, and apparently it's still the same today, that the monster, in this particular case tarantula, he only went after and killed and sucked the blood out of pretty young women. The fat, ugly ones he left alone. And apparently it's still the same today. Vampires and zombies, they only attack the attractive ones. So if there is ever a real zombie or vampire attack, you know, put on some weight, take off your makeup, and the zombies will leave you alone. Apparently it's true in the movies. So anyway, there was a zombie attacking the beautiful girls and stuff. And soon enough, you know, they're trying to make it exciting. The zombie, no, not zombie this time, tarantula's crawling around, you know, behind people, trying to catch them. And sure enough, one of the students in the audience shouted out at the screen, "Look out! Tarantula's behind you!" And the tarantula can't hear human voices anyway, and it's only a movie. But why is it that people actually get involved in movies? Why do you get excited? Why do you cry? It's exactly the same phenomenon which happens when people watch football matches. You literally, psychologically, get sucked into the screen. You're right there, within the movie. You're right there, next to the beautiful girl being attacked by a tarantula. You're in the stands of Old Trafford watching matches to play. You actually, your perception at that time is you're there. Which is why you shout. It's why you scream, why you cry, because you become part of the movie, part of the football match. You get sucked in. And that was an interesting insight, because that is actually why we can't be peaceful and still. We get a thought going on in our mind. It's like the movie, the football match, we get sucked in. As if we're right there in the middle of that fantasy. As if we're reliving that memory. As if we're right in there, in our future plans and dreams. We get sucked in. And obviously, the way to overcome that and get some peace in life, to get some detachment, to get some perspective, is actually, when you're watching the movie, feel the seat. When you're watching that football, realise that you are thousands of miles away. Even if you're in London, they can't hear you in Old Trafford. So, fake weather time shouting. So sit back and realise it's only a movie. It's only a replay. You can't do anything. Put some space between you and your thoughts. Push your thoughts. No, this is metaphorically. Put your thoughts out there. And you, the watcher, is in here. And there's a space between the observer and the thing being watched. When you put that space between you and what's being watched, you find you don't shout. Now watch out behind you, tarantula's coming. You don't sort of say, shoot, 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 offside. Because you've got that space there, that perspective, you do not get entangled in all of those thoughts and other processes which are going on in your mind. You can let go once you have space between you, whatever you're thinking. That becomes very helpful. And you will find that when you do get caught up in thinking, thoughts and fantasies, dreams, and projections for the future, you actually found that's a very accurate simile to what's happening. You get caught up in it. You're right inside of it, as if it's really happening, as if it's really important. That is why you can't find any peace. So if you can just imagine standing back and watching whatever's happening at a distance, you have to be mindful, but at a distance. Then you'll find so easy to let go, So many of those thoughts and fantasies and dreams are seen for what they are. Really stupid. They will never happen. Again, I recall going on some flight somewhere. And I was sitting, you know, they have these, in the old aircraft, the screens drop down from the roof of the aircraft, from the ceiling. And I was sitting right in front of one. I couldn't miss it. So, you know, I didn't have a chance except not to look at it unless I closed my eyes. And I remember it to this day. It was the movie Armageddon. Now, you don't need to watch the whole movie to know what happens. The world is about to end. There's two guys or girls come, and just right at the last, right at the very, very, very last second, they just manage to save the world. And they also have to be Americans to save the world. I'm sorry, but Malaysians, you know, will never save the world. If it wasn't for the Americans, the world would have ended a long time ago. And they have to fight, first of all, and all sorts of obstacles go in the way. And so I didn't have the headphones, I was just watching the screen. And the scene which I will remember till I die, it was one of the most funniest things I've ever seen. And yeah, I used to follow Monty Python. I loved comedy when I was a kid, but this beat most of the Monty Python sketches. More funny than a dead parrot sketch. And I forget who the heroes were, but the hero, this really good looking young man, was going in some spacecraft. He had to land on this asteroid or meteor which is going to crash into the Earth and destroy civilization as we know it. It's really exciting. And he crashed into this meteor. He came in and I was going, okay. Anyway, crashing into a meteor. And as it crashed, it burst into flames. There were sparks everywhere. And it rolled and explosions and more sparks and more flames. For about 1 or 2 minutes, you could actually see so much pyrotechnics, much more than a terrorist attack in Baghdad, much more than Guy Fawkes Night. There were so many explosions and flashes and stuff, and then it fell down this huge cliff, and at the bottom of the cliff there's more explosions and crashes. It was enough to make anybody die 50 times. But this is our hero. So everything went quiet. At last, the spaceship came to a halt. And then you saw on the screen a hand come up. And the hero pulled himself up. He survived. Now that was very, very hard to take. But when you saw his hair was perfectly blue. No, exactly, that's what I did. I was laughing my head off. This is absolutely stupid. But I looked around, and all the people watching this with their headphones, he survived and was so relieved and happy. It was absolutely ridiculous. But you can see why people got caught up in it. Just putting the music on their headphones was what allowed them to get really sucked in for me, because I was just looking at a disc and I wasn't getting sucked in at all. And it was just such a stupid movie. Absolutely ridiculous. No way in the world could anything like that ever happen. Therefore, I can let it go. And I use that as a simile to let go of all the thoughts, the fantasies, the dreams, all that other stuff which you create. Put some space between it, and it's easier to let it go. Don't get caught up. So when we can actually view these things at a distance, that's real mindfulness, mindfulness, wisdom, space, which means that we can eventually put the cup down. There's a space between me and that cup now, which means it can become still. And then your mind becomes still. You don't have to be thinking, 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 which is one of the biggest obstacles in meditation. Oh my goodness, we think so much. You know, sometimes you have to think. Poor old Chanda, she's having to think to organize all of this. But now, Venerable Chandra, you've been too tired. I now ban you from thinking. Am I your teacher?
Yeah.
Are you going to follow my advice?
Absolutely.
Okay, no more thinking. But I kept you thinking, I'm just banging on him. And you don't need to think either. What do you need to think about? You know the lunch is going to be coming down there later on. You don't have to think about lunch. You don't have to think about performing. You're not going to get assessed at the end of this retreat. I'm not going to give you a grade A, B, C, D, E, F. And if I do, anyway, you know what F means? Fantastic. E, excellent. A means arrogant. I tell this to kids when they get the results from school. I got an A. You arrogant young man. I got an F. Fantastic. Or the parent keeps saying here, fab. That's what F means. So, and D is delightful. So, we are not going to measure you, so for goodness sake, stop trying to achieve anything. It's a waste of time. No one's going to know. No one's going to tell you what a great meditator you are. You're not going to get a star if you get good meditation. So why not just let things be? No need to think, because there's nothing to achieve. So much in life, you have performance assessments. There's always someone over your shoulder making sure you do the work. If it's not your boss, it's your mother. If it's not your mother, your father, or someone, always tell you, not good enough, try harder, do this, get that done. In a meditation retreat, you're totally free. You don't have to achieve anything. You don't have to get anywhere. No goals, no aspirations, nothing to aim for. You mean for the next 2 days you can just be. For goodness sake, never try to get enlightened. You just get stressed. Never try to get deep meditation. You just get frustrated. Don't try to get anything. Instead, just try to be. To be here, in this moment, enjoying this moment, not trying to go anywhere. So when you try to go somewhere, where are you trying to go anyway? Sometimes people say, where am I going to go after this retreat? What do you mean? You've only just started this retreat. Why are you thinking about where you're going to go next? Instead, see as much as you can how you can be here, right now. Leave next to later. So, in this retreat, one moment at a time. Now, what was that story? I was busily working in my monastery office. One of my friends used to be a monk before. I always have to watch out for ex-monks, they know as much as I do. And this ex-monk said, how are you going? How are you, Ajahn Brahm? And I replied to him, I'm getting there. Never ever say that. I said, I'm getting there. And then he looked at me and said, exactly where is it you're getting to, Ajahn Brahm? Realizing I was caught out, I told him, I was being honest, where I'm getting to is my coffin. That's where I'm going. And that's where you're going too. So then if you're trying to get somewhere, that's where you're going. So before you get there, it's actually true, isn't it? So please don't tell people I'm getting there. So I changed my attitude, and when people ask me that question now, I say, I'm being here. Not getting somewhere. I'm being here. And that is your job for this retreat. Not to get somewhere, but to be here. To be here as many moments as you possibly can through the next couple of days. What should I do? People ask. What do you mean doing? That's getting somewhere, going somewhere. Just be. Is that difficult? To be. You don't have to be anyone or anything, just whatever happens, whatever comes along. So all you're really doing here is just be. Such a simple way of meditating. And sometimes they say, well, if you don't try and get somewhere, you'll get nowhere. Exactly. Nowhere is where enlightenment lives. In this wonderful realm called nowhere. So if you're getting nowhere, you're getting closer and closer and closer. If you're doing nothing, as I mentioned a couple of times during this trip, when this Christian friend came up to me, I do have friends from many, many different religions. I was just about to go to Malaysia to give a series of talks, and he decided to teach me his truth. He looked at me, I've known you a long time, I said, well, I need to tell you this. Nothing is better than God. That's what he said, a Christian, nothing is better than God. So, what should I say? And I said, I agree with you. Nothing, emptiness, the void, is much higher than your God. And he looked at me, that is not what I meant. So, if you're achieving nothing, sadhu, 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 you're a really great meditator. That's what we're supposed to be achieving. Nothing. Great emptiness. Nothing there. Whoa. So the reason I'm saying these things, I'm trying somehow to make sure that you don't interfere with the meditation process. It's a natural process. It happens when you stop trying to do it. The mind gets peaceful, the mind gets still, just like that glass of water. Look, that's been still. How long has that been still? Totally easy. No effort at all. Can you be still for that long? If you know how to let go, it's so easy to do. Sit there and just watch. Sometimes we say with kindness. I think this retreat was called something like delighting with another. I can do kindness here. Anyway. I thought it was summer. Other retreat. Kindness, you know, compassion is a way of letting go. Sometimes the people think it's different, but it's not. When you're kind to somebody, really compassionate to them, you love them for who they are. Has anyone got a cat? We got cats in our monastery. Oh, they come when they want to feed, and then they disappear for days sometimes. And then they come back again when they want some more food. You know that they're supposed to be living in a monastery, they're only supposed to be eating in the morning time. But we can't control our cats. Sometimes we thought of actually shaving their hair. Some exercise, but no, they won't allow us to do that either. You know, I can't control a cat. Can't change it at all. We allow it to fix. A little cat, just give it some fish or give it something. Try and make it a vegetarian. Have a look at your cat's face if you try that. No, cats are cats are cats are cats. But you still love them. You don't try and change them. You love them for who they are. You let them be. Just a cat. Or a little dog. Or the weather. Or your kids. Yeah, you love your kids to be well and happy, but you still love them anyhow. And this is actually called letting go. It's letting something be. So, you say to your mind. Your poor old mind, which is very, very, very similar to a cat. It likes to eat and sleep all day. Give it half a chance. To curl up in some nice warm little corner, then all chunder, and just have a snooze. Would you like that? You would, yeah. So we paint some whiskers on your face, and they feel to be a cat, and then they won't say, what are you doing? So, when you see a cat like that, you love them, you let them be, you're not trying to change them. That's their nature, that's your nature too. So be kind to yourself. Which is another way of saying, let yourself be. Yeah, you've got all sorts of defilements, all sorts of bad stuff. Have you? Who said it's bad stuff? In the time of the Buddha, we had all sorts of people who became fully enlightened. They weren't all paragons, highly intelligent, restrained. And it's actually very hard sometimes to find out who the enlightened ones were and who they weren't. They weren't all sitting up like robots, never laughing. Mighty Ajahn Chah, he was a joker. He was just had us laughing just most of the day with his antics, always doing something weird, something out of the ordinary. Oh, what? Okay, I'm going to upset a few people. One of the grossest things he said, which made us laugh so much. I was in back seat of a car, two other monks. There was Ajahn Chah in the passenger seat and the driver. We were going to the railway station to send somebody off or to receive somebody. So, three monks in the back, actually two monks and a novice. I was a monk. The novice was this guy, I still remember his name. He was from New Mexico, also Los Angeles. And he, sitting in the back during the journey, and Ajahn Chah suddenly turned around and looked at this novice and through the translator told him, "You are thinking of your girlfriend back in LA, aren't you? It's very dangerous to have any fantasies or thoughts like that when you're sitting right behind Ajahn Chah." He could read minds. He picked it up straight away. And I felt really sorry for this young American novice. He'd been busted in front of everybody else. But then Ajahn Chah was a really, really kind monk. And then he said, "Oh, no, never mind, it's natural. You've only just become a monk. And you probably met your girlfriend back in Los Angeles. So look, I can help you." And through the translator he said, "Next time you write to your girlfriend..." This monk was a novice, but you know, he still had feelings for this girl. "If next time you write to your girlfriend back in Los Angeles, ask her to send something personal of hers so that you can, when you feel lonely, when you miss her, you can remember her." You know, like people actually do that. I don't know if when I was a young man they did that, but if they still do, like, you know, a piece of her dress, you know, with her scent on, or like a lock of her hair. So when you're separating, you take that lock of the hair. "Oh, that's my girlfriend." You know, so you don't feel so separated. And straight away he said to his other, "Is that allowed? Is that appropriate for like a monastic to do that?" And I said, "Oh yes, 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 compassion is really important, it's allowable." And then when I go to Ajahn Chah, the translator took about 5 minutes to translate. Because he couldn't stop laughing, couldn't bring himself together to translate. He said, "Ajahn Chah said, but don't get a lock of her hair, don't get a piece of her dress with her scent on. Send her a little bottle and ask for some of her shit." So the next time you miss your girlfriend, open the bottle. "Oh, that's my girlfriend back in LA. It's personal." And isn't it the case? When you fall in love, "I love everything about you, my darling." "Everything?" And the same advice would hold to nuns. Ex-boyfriends, ask for a bottle of this shit. That was so dark. Oops, what was that? Anyway, it's okay, leave it down there. That's a child's grass. It was so entertaining. When you're meditating, just when you can sort of let go and have some loving kindness, really peaceful, it makes you very light and happy. Which is where it comes to delighting in the selfless presence. Because when you get very peaceful, you don't get the light coming up. Everything gets really funny. You laugh very easily. You smile very easily. One of the reasons is because when the mind becomes peaceful, the mindfulness becomes stronger, you see more, whatever you see is beautiful, and you get happier and happier and happier. This is a part of meditation that I learned, I practice, I teach. If your meditation is really getting strong, hi, please come in. Hey, it's traffic, not your fault. We believe in non-self here, so no one's to blame for anything. So, learn how to be happy just by being still. And hopefully During the next 2 days, you'll have moments of peace and stillness where you really wake up, your mindfulness increases in its power, and also you feel really delightfully happy. A big smile on your face, and wonder for what reason. Because one of the insights I wish you to understand is how stillness leads to happiness. The two are linked together. Now when you get still and you get happy, you also get very aware. And okay, the awareness and other insights might come, but what most people in a place like London need is a little bit more happiness in their life. Real happiness and joy. Look at your faces, hardly any of you are smiling. I hope that changes by the end of this retreat. Usually you know that people take photographs at retreats. And I would like to take photographs in the middle of the retreat, when people are happy. But in my retreats, at the very end of the retreat, everyone is miserable. The retreat's finished, I don't want to go home. Because people said that, some of these retreats are really tough, really, really strict. And those types of retreat, they always take the photograph at the end of the retreat. And all the meditators are so happy, big smiles on their face. You know why? Because they're going home. So during this retreat, learning how to let go, pull things down, is also timetables. For goodness sake, do not keep the timetable. Please, I ban you from keeping timetables. It's at all possible. Except, apparently, you know, otherwise, Paul Chandler gets really crazy because he gets some complaints from people. There are tea breaks. Now this is England, so we always have to have tea breaks. And for those of you who don't know, that is why I was English too. I was born in Middlesex Hospital, grew up in Acton, schooled in Hammersmith. This was my area, West London. This is a bit south West London. I used to go around sort of Richmond. But this was a bit too sad for me. A bit too posh. But nevertheless. We do have these tea breaks. But yeah, being English, when I did go to Thailand looking for a teacher, I didn't know where to go. You know, when I first found out there was a meditation master called Ajahn Chah. A monk whose name meant tea. I thought, wow, that is a monk for an Englishman like me. So I went to spend 9 years with Ajahn Tee. And the other weird stuff, you know, I did tell a story, but I don't think you really got it, but absolutely true, that when Ajahn Chah visited Hampstead for a few days, many years ago, only once, and when he returned to Thailand, they were always interested what was his experiences of London. And also we asked him, did he learn any English when he was there? He had lots of English or Western disciples, but he didn't know any English when he was in Thailand. But when he came here, he said yes. He learned one word in English. Only one word. That's the only word he learned in about a week or 2 weeks of stay in this country. You know what that word was? Cup of tea. That's the word he learned. He said, oh yeah, I know English. Cup of tea. Cup of tea, cup of tea. I wonder why that was. Because he heard that so many times. So anyway, there are cups of tea, and apparently because of the people looking after us, that's only time for tea? Yes, they have to have the tea in those times. So is there a copy of the schedule somewhere where people...
there's one
study
scanning room.
Yeah, okay, so you can see that when it's at downstairs.
On the whiteboard.
On the whiteboard
in that room.
Yeah. Okay. And you have the lunch breaks as well. But outside of that, honestly, please don't sort of say, oh, it's now's the time I should meditate, now's the time I get up, now's the time I do this, now's the time I do that. Because that really messed me up when I was young. I used to go to retreats when you have like 50 minutes of meditation, had a bell. See, there's no bells here. See, there's no bells? That's on purpose. Because on my retreats, we practice no bell silence. People don't, look, that's the trouble, they don't understand what that word means. That word came about noble silence, and people think noble silence means not talking. Well, that's stupid, that's not what noble silence means, noble silence. Which means that you don't have to follow bells. This is not going back to school again. If you don't come on time, you have to stand in the corner. It's just stupid stuff. Because when I was going to these retreats, you know, quite frankly, sometimes 50 minutes or an hour was too much for me. And after half an hour, my legs were killing me, my back was terrible, mind all over the place. Another 10 or 20 minutes to go. It was torture. I really thought that, you know those pea shooters we used to have? I thought of actually getting one of those and aiming at the bell. Ding, ding, ding! And getting up, because I actually thought of that. Stop ringing the bell early. And the teacher would know what's going on. Everyone would be left before the time if you get it out. Have you thought about that? What, going to some of these retreats? I'm sure you have. And then other times I'm just getting so peaceful. Really, just another minute I would be enlightened. Ding, ding, ding. Oh, why did you ring the bell? And the point was, it was not natural. There are times when you want to sit much longer. There are times it's too long. And that really messes up your meditation. So here, please, you sit down, and if it's meditate, if a thought comes up, and you really have had enough, then for goodness sake, get up. If you're sitting there and you're still having a nice meditation, carry on. Don't be a slave, a prisoner of time. So that way you can get much deeper meditation here. Number two, you don't have to meditate in this room. There's so many good downstairs in the gardens.
There's a chapel.
There's a chapel down there.
Downstairs.
Yeah, get some help from Jesus in your meditation. I'm only joking. I've got to be careful with these jokes. It's like I've never realised they're coming here.
It's very meditative in the chapel.
Oh, very good. Okay, good. And? In the gardens,
yep.
Grounds, nice warm afternoon, find a nice tree. They've probably got enlightened under a tree. So the trees are really cool to get enlightened under. So find a nice tree to meditate under or whatever, or even in your room. My room is like my cave. Lock the door, get as many cushions as you like, and then you can meditate in there. You don't need to meditate here with everybody. Wherever it is, you feel really good, that's the place to meditate. And also, as Venerable Chanda said, this place has got grounds. At last you have a place you can do walking meditation. Now, we did a retreat over in Mary Ward Hall in the centre of London, Russell Square. Yeah, people did do some walking meditation over there, but I was a bit concerned. I didn't actually encourage it. You know why? Because inside is very small, confined. If you went to one of the parks, you had to actually cross the road. You know, and to cross the road, it's only when the green man is flashing. Sometimes people walk so slowly. Yeah, you start when the green man is flashing. You've only got a third of the way over the road, and the red man is flashing. You haven't even got halfway yet. I'm very concerned for you that you're walking so slowly in meditation you wouldn't make it across the road. You know, I'm walking, I can't resist this story. Absolutely true. Sometimes jokes are based on real events, real stories, and this particular event was when there was a Vipassana retreat being held in the retreat centre opposite my monastery. We built a lovely retreat centre there. And so other people use it, because as a Buddhist, I like my tradition, but any other traditions we want to support, we're trying to have some harmony and peace. So another tradition was using our retreat centre. And they were doing this, the slow walking, the Vipassana walking, where you walk really slowly. And also that particular day, there was a family, it was a Sri Lankan family who came to visit with their children. And they asked if they could see the retreat center. I said, yeah, sure, but be quiet because there's a retreat going on there. And they came back after a quick visit, and their children were so excited and frightened. And they told me, I said, what's up? They said, I don't know, you've got to go to your retreat center. It's been invaded by zombies. Because that's what the children thought this walking meditation was. Walking, lifting. Because apparently, in the movies, that's what zombies do. Walking very slowly. And so actually they thought people doing walking meditation were zombies invading our retreat centre. So all of that, because of that story, you always call that slow walking meditation zombie meditation. If you want to try it, it's very, very good. Zombie meditation. You can see, keep a sense of humour, keep light-hearted. So you can do some walking meditation. For those of you who haven't done walking meditation before, you don't have to go slow, you don't have to go fast. Now, in where I grew up in Thailand, some people would walk fast, some people would walk slow. Some people walk very fast. It does not matter. Whatever you feel is the right speed for you, you walk at that speed. Nothing is right. It's only whether it's convenient for you. But if you are walking meditation, just like sitting meditation, please, in the present moment, no past, no future, no goals. In fact, I like walking meditation because you can start at one point, go to the other end, and come back again. Then one of the great parts of walking meditation, you don't get anywhere. You end up exactly where you started. That is cool. Not getting anywhere. So, because overcoming people's having to get somewhere, having to develop, having to do something. So please get that out of your head as much as you possibly can. So, backwards and forwards, you put your gaze 2 meters in front of you. Not to the left, not to the right. Keep your eyes open, otherwise you'll hit the trees. And we haven't got insurance. So, go forward 2 meters in front of you roughly, and when you always feel the movement of your feet as you're walking, you don't need to say lifting, you can actually feel that. So right now, to show what I mean, don't avert your gaze, can you now lift your right arm? Don't look at it, just, how do you know you're lifting it? You can feel it, now put it back down again. Can you feel all those sensations of an arm moving? That's what you do with your legs. As your left leg moves, you can feel it moving up, going forward, going down. As the right leg does the next step, you can actually feel it, all the sensations in the legs. At first you might think it's boring, but after a little while it becomes incredibly fascinating. All the thousands of muscles which have to move just for one step, and you start to become aware of them all. Literally, because your mind is having a simple object to watch, just the movement of the legs, soon, because you're not thinking of the past or the future, and the feelings in the legs are dominating your consciousness, then what happens is the mind gets very peaceful, and very bright and happy. You get this beautiful joy coming up in the meditation, which is what is supposed to happen. Meditation is supposed to make you happy, joyful. Otherwise, why have you paid money to come here just for misery? If you want misery, you can just go and stay home or go to work. Make some money and be miserable instead of actually spending money and being miserable. So meditation retreat is supposed to make you happy. And it's absolutely true. My meditation retreats, people do get happy. There's one lady from Singapore, no, not from Singapore, from Sydney. One of the chief executives of a company. She stressed out, but she had a big boss, and she had to beg and grovel, you know, just for 1 week of meditation, and grovel and plead and all sorts of stuff, but eventually her boss let her come. And she sent me an email sort of on the Monday, first day of work at lunchtime, said her boss at work couldn't believe how happy she was. And he told her, he said, look, I don't know what drugs they give you in those Buddhist monasteries, but please bring me back some next time. He thought it was drugs, because he couldn't understand just how anyone could be so happy just through meditating and doing nothing all week. But you hopefully can find that out. So you get relaxed, you get peace, you get happy, your mindfulness increases. As your mindfulness increases, the wisdom comes, starts streaming in, you've got a powerful mind, insight comes, and you get even deeper and more wonderful experiences with meditation. That's what we're doing here. Peace, stillness, happiness, insight, freedom. Such a beautiful path, with no pain. You know, sometimes people do breath meditation, I'll talk about it later on. You know what breath meditation is called in Pali? Anapanasati. Ana is a Pali word meaning, in this case, along with. Pana is the breath. For those people who are Buddhist, Pana, Atipata, Viramani, the first piece of not destroying living beings. It's the same thing. Pana means breath, and Pana also means breathing beings, right? And so many similarities between the Indian languages and English, and especially Latin. You know the word for breath in Latin? Animalis. Animal. That's where animals, the name comes from. It literally means having breath. So that's exactly the same with the Indian word, prana. So anapanasati means mindfulness along with the breath. Anapanasati. There was never any meditation called anapanasati, which means mindfulness along with the pain. Like absolutely stupid stuff. So if you're having pain, move. If you're itching, you know the best antidote to itching? Scratching. People are crazy, they go, I better not scratch. Instead, I'm going to conquer my body. I'm going to resist it. I don't care how much it's going to itch. I'm not going to scratch. And you just have this terrible battle for half an hour. One scratch, and then you can meditate properly. No problem at all. You're absolutely crazy. Coughing. Please cough, for goodness sake. There's nothing wrong with coughing. In fact, there's a lot of problem not coughing. It's called volcano effect in meditation. I'm not going to cough, okay? I'm not going to cough. Don't disturb anybody. I don't want to cough. What you're doing is you're bunging up your throat just like the vent of a volcano gets all stuffed up. And it just, what they do, just builds up pressure. It builds and builds and builds. It's going to blow. You know it's going to blow, you're going to big coughing fit. And when it does blow, a volcano, when it blows, all this really dangerous, toxic stuff goes miles around the volcano. Just like you, all this toxic, I don't know, bodily fluids goes around the people sitting behind you, especially the person in front of you, they really cough it. And a few other people too. And you think, you know, you don't want to disturb anybody. A few little coughs beforehand hardly disturbs anyone. But when you do blow with a coughing fit, everybody gets disturbed. Even those poor nuns who rent out this retreat from here on the other side of the retreat centre. So, for goodness sake, if you feel like coughing, cough. If you feel like sneezing, sneeze. Be kind to your body. You know what happens next then? If you just cough when you need to cough, coughing soon disappears. Because you're kind and relaxed, the tension in your body gets less, and all these little things are not strong anymore. So here you go, just how you can actually use this retreat as best you possibly can and have a wonderful time here. Now many of you have done all sorts of different types of meditation. I'm not going to get inside your head and find what you're doing when your eyes are closed. You can be doing all sorts of different types of meditation procedures, you can be thinking about sex, you can be planning to write your biography. I'm not going to read your mind. Anyone who can read another person's mind, they only usually read one or two people's mind, and that's it, never again. Quite frankly, your minds are not worth reading. I'm just being frank, okay? It's true, you know. It's like reading, you know, junk novel. So he's heard that he's saying, he says, don't be afraid, just learn how to relax and let go. So there's enough instructions for now. The time is 10:30. What time's the tea break?
There isn't
one. No tea break?
No, we've had it.
Had it? Well, okay. Okay. So meditation and guidance. Okay, no, meditation guidance. It's all meditation guidance. Okay, so what I'm going to do now, just for the next 5-10 minutes, just any basic questions about meditation that you want to ask now? Go on, yeah?
Where do you watch your breath?
Excellent question. And I want you now to close your eyes and breathe in and out 3 times. After the third breath, open your eyes. Only 3 breaths, not 100. You know, some people can't count. That's why I said that the power was only. I almost killed you, didn't I? 3 types of people to be found in the world: those who can count and those who can't. So, only 3 breaths, okay? So, where were you watching the breath? I teach this to people first time when they do breath meditation. And because of that, they haven't been told where they should watch the breath, they just watch the breath. Easy, anyone can do that. You watch the breath not at a particular place in your body. You're not watching your body, you're watching the breath. You don't need to locate it anywhere in the body to know your breath has gone in, out, in, out, in, out. Don't watch your nose. Don't watch your belly. Watch your breath. You know, sometimes people would complain about, when I first went to Malaysia, they called it meditation headache. And that really stunned me. I never heard that in Thailand. I never get a headache. I meditate to overcome headaches, to get past them, not to create them. And then for about a year, I could not figure out what the heck was going on. Until I realised people were watching the tip of the nose when I'm meditating. Because what happens if you try and say, close your eyes, watch the tip of the nose? What happens? I have to take my glasses off so you can see this clearly. And I'm going to meditate on the tip of my nose, but with my eyelids open. Now I'm going to meditate on the tip of my nose. And this is just what happens naturally, without you really realising it. You start watching the tip of the nose. Because while your mind watches, your eyes go to. And already I'm getting very tense in my forehead. And if I stay like this for too long, I'm going to get a headache. It's such an obvious thing. And that's why when people watch the tip of the nose, they get tension headaches across here. So don't watch the tip of the nose. Watch wherever the breath happens to be. You're watching the breath, not the nose. Now the other thing is you watch your belly. Now it's okay for you, but as a monk or a nun, we should never watch our belly, especially about 4, 5, or 6 o'clock in the afternoon. That is so close to your stomach. You're trying to watch the breath, rising, falling, I'm hungry, I want something to eat. So that's not a good place to watch either. Instead, you just watch the breath. So simple. Watch the breath. Do you understand that? It's important. It's also the case, if you don't really associate the feeling of the breath with any part of your body, it's just watching the breath. It has a great advantage that you're letting go of the body as early as possible. You're just watching the breath. As a very good summary of what we're doing in meditation, we're totally letting go of our body so we can get into our mind, the sixth sense. It's very hard just to let go of the body with its five senses. So we have like a stepping stone halfway across the stream called the mind, called the breath. So put all of our attention onto the breath and everything else in the body is anxious. Can't feel the feet, the legs, the arms, the bottom, the back, the head. Eyes closed, we're not seeing anything, not hearing anything, smelling, taste, that's all gone. All the five senses are gone except the feeling of the breath. That's the stepping stone. We've not left the body yet. We've still got the breath, the last bit of the body left. And then because we're very calm and still, we don't need to breathe so much. The level of oxygen required is very low. And so we breathe softer and softer and softer. And then eventually, so soft, the breath vanishes. We've made that next step across from the body into the realm of the mind. That's one of the other great insights you get, what this mind actually is. And you don't really know that when the body is all there, and all the five senses are dominating our consciousness. And it's a beautiful world, the world of the mind. Joyful, blissful, and it's an amazing insight what happens there. And also some powers too. So that's a description of what we're doing here. Letting go of the body, onto the breath, and then onto the world of the mind. Thank you for that question. Another question. Yeah. If you've got physical pain, if there's something you can do about it, please do so. If you can adjust your posture, you know, get a softer chair. You can wheel your bed in here. If you do, everyone else will want to as well. So you can try even like in your room meditating on your bed if you've got lots of physical pain. So if there's something you can do, do something about it. If there's nothing you can do because it's something chronic, something deep inside of you, sitting any which way doesn't really heal it, then you can go to the deeper way of dealing with pain. We talked with a lot of people about that during this trip. All you really do is you get fully mindful of it. Like the simile I give is like Google Maps. For your whole body, you zoom in onto that pain. Zoom in until it fills your whole mind. So you're mindful of it. And once you're fully mindful of that pain, then you can actually notice that it comes and goes, increases and decreases. Sometimes it's very painful, sometimes the pain gets less. The longer you can observe that, the quicker you'll notice that what really affects that pain more than anything else is the attitude of mind. And so you can play around with the mind. In other words, try and get rid of it. Leave it, let it be. Be kind to it. And you'll find that when you're kind to it and let it be, the pain gets less. You're now discovering how you can manipulate that pain, control it even, with the attitude of your mind. And with practice, you can control it so well, you relax the mind so well in pain, it vanishes. Now that's an incredible thing to be able to do. I've done that sometimes. I've been telling people that there was a woman from Eastern Europe, chronic arthritis, taking severe medication with all bad side effects, just to be able to survive the day. Because arthritis can be very, very, very painful. It can mean you can't do anything in the world. Yeah, you're alive, but being tortured 24/7. The only medication could make her tolerate roughly her body. But that was not really much of a solution. So she got on YouTube, followed my meditation instructions, and wrote this beautiful email. Thank you, Ajahn Brahe. No more medication. No more arthritis, no more pain. I've got my life back. That's really beautiful to read that. It can be done, but you have to be quite courageous. So zoom in on pain and just to learn just how to lessen it. First you only lessen it a tiny bit. That encourages you, it can be done. A tiny bit more. And soon, through repeated exercise, you can actually totally let it go. That's amazing. So give that a try. You won't be able to do that on this retreat. You'll be able to get a little way. You go home and continue. And once you get going, once you know what to do, then it's every just 5% is just so much relief. And encouraging too. And then 10%, 20%, 50%, and it all goes, and then wow, great life back. Amazing. Oh yes,
How tight should be the focus on the breath? Do we use it just as a support for awareness, or are we just in awareness?
The best way, how I meditate, I don't even go looking for the breath. I wait for the breath to come to me. Relax the body, relax the mind. And soon everything else disappears and breath is the last thing left. I never choose to watch the breath. It always comes. What's happening, you're only aware of things which move. When you sit still, now you close your eyes, nothing is moving, so the actual sight vanishes. It's not you seeing darkness. You see darkness for about 1 or 2 seconds, and then sight turns off. As long as no one bangs the door, the sound in this room is pretty constant, so after a while, you're not hearing anymore. Smell, taste, very easy to let go of. But the physical body, you have to be comfortable, and eventually just you can't feel your body. So those are the 5 senses. They've all been calmed down. But the thing which is very difficult to calm down is your breathing. You always have to breathe in and out, it's always moving. But that's the last thing which is moving, and usually that happens quite naturally. The breath meditation is the most famous type of meditation. Not because you choose to do it, because even if you don't choose to do it, it happens anyway. So just become aware of your breath. Of course, if you want to go to the breath early, choose to do it, please don't go too early. Because what happens to many people, they decide to watch the breath and they're not ready yet. The mindfulness is not strong enough. So the only way they can watch the breath is an iron grip. And for goodness sake, don't do that practice every time the breath, the mind wanders away from the breath, bring it back. Wanders off, bring it back. Wanders off, bring it back. Wanders off, bring it back. Wanders off. You spend the whole time doing that. And it never stays with you. It always wanders off again. So don't just repeating stuff which doesn't work. Why does it wander off? A lot of times you're holding it too tight. Hold it very lightly, and then it doesn't wander off anymore. Sometimes we keep a bird in a cage with a locked door. One day you're going to leave the cage door open, and that bird is going to fly away and never come back. That's not the way to keep a bird in a cage. That's not the way to keep your mind on the breath, by keeping the breath in a cage. Instead, you make your cage really comfortable. Really beautiful food, exactly what your bird likes. Really pampering it and indulging it, a nice quiet place to sleep. Plenty of toys to play with. It doesn't matter you leave the cage door open. The bird loves your cage so much, it might fly away to see its friends. Always come back again quickly. Because it loves this little cage. That is by your breath. Thank you. I'm trying to let go of time. So, thank you. So the same with the breathing. If you just try and lock the breath up, when it goes away, it's hard to come back again. But if you just be kind to your breath, Treat your breathing like a friend, not as a slave. Many people feel like a slave. Controlling it. Breath, come here. Stay. Breathing slowly now. Come on, breathe slowly. I'm telling you, I'm warning you, now breathing fast. You know, you're treating your breath like you own it and control it. Like, you know, you've got power over it. A control freak. Instead, you should always treat your breath like your best friend. Sometimes, actually, I do that. I look at my breath and say, thank you. Breath, you've been coming in and out of my body for over 65 years. You've never missed one breath yet. I'm still alive. Thank you so much. When I'm asleep, when I'm busy, when I'm sick, you still always come in and go out at the right time, keeping me healthy. Thank you. And a deep thank you to your breath. It's something like that the breath appreciates it and wants to stay with you because you treat it with respect, with kindness. Okay, this is a bit of anthropomorphism, putting like a consciousness on just a process, but it works. So be kind. Anthropomorphism is making a being, a human being, out of, say, a machine. Like your car, how many people give your car names? And sometimes you treat it like it's got consciousness, like it's a sentient being. And then it works. Honestly, so many stories. You know, your car is, you know, almost running out of fuel, or it breaks down, and you just stroke it and just say, oh, look, I know I treated you really hard, I should have really taken the mechanic, but you know, it's 5 miles from, can you make the last 5 miles, please? And it does. So many stories. That. For me, I never owned a car, I owned a cement mixer. And honestly, other people could not get that cement mixer to work. Every time I pulled the string to get it going, I'd always stroke it and say, thank you for all your service. Now please, can you do a little bit more? And it'll do that. But actually, well, I don't know if you have it here, but you know, school fairs, to raise money for the school. Over in Perth, someone brought a camel. And camel rides for the raise money for the school. Yeah, but, you know, it's weird like riding a camel. So, you know, like, $1 around the park and back, you know, for the kids. And Perth, in my country of Australia, is really hot. So this camel had been going all day, taking kids around. And then, the end of the day, 5 o'clock, time to pack up, and then this kid, so came there and said, Mummy, I really want a camel ride. Can I have a camel ride? Please, a camel ride. So they took him to the guy and said, we're packing up now. And the kid said, oh, please. I said, okay. And so the kid told the camel, get down. Camel wouldn't move. Camel had enough. So you know, what the guy did, saw this. The guy went to his camel, stroked him and said, look, you've done work really hard, raising so much money for the local school. It's just a wonderful, wonderful thing you've done today. This kid has come from such a long way. He spoke to the camel. Now, would you mind just one more round? And the camel got down straight away to help. Just like, there was another guy who was knocking door to door, raising funds, because the local school was building a swimming pool for the kids. So he knocked on the door, and the guy answered, said, I'm collecting donations for the swimming pool for the local school. Can you help? The guy asked, oh yes, certainly, just wait a moment. And he came back 1 minute later with a tumbler of water. This is donation for the kids' swimming pool. Anyway, so that's actually what happens. Yeah. So what we can do now, because so you're having your lunch at 12 o'clock, correct?
12:30.
Oh, 12:30. We're having our lunch at 12:30 because we're monks and lunch we have the week before. No, because you have a dinner in the evening.
No, they don't.
They don't. But actually, just round the corner. Yeah, and there's always like, do you have takeaway pizzas here? Bring out pizza, please. For room number two. I'm a strict monk. My rule is very strict. I just compassion for people. Anyway, so what we're going to do now is going to do some meditation. But first of all, I think, because you'll be sitting down for a while, so maybe let's take a 5 or 10 minute toilet break. Is that a good idea? Okay. And then you can come back, what time is it? 11 o'clock.
Okay.
And then we'll do a meditation.